Six Music.
BBC Radio, Six Music Documentaries.
This is BBC.
BBC Radio.
Six Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time with Tom Morello.
I'm Matt Everett and welcome to The First Time here on BBC Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shape their lives and their careers. And we kick off this new series with a brilliant musician. His first professional band set out to be the political Led Zeppelin and pretty much succeeded by blending thundering metal riffs, hip-hop and impassioned lyrics, attacking, amongst other things, corporate America, social injustice and government oppression. That band was Rage Against the Machine and I guess provided the guitar onslaught that characterised that group. From there he ended up channelling his not inconsiderable skill and passion for protest into a series of supergroups. Everyone has been as defiant, committed and sonically impressive, right up to the present day with his latest outfit, the Atlas Underground. My guest on The First Time this week is Tom Morello. Here, Tom talks about the music and social environment that shaped his early life and how an enthusiasm for metal evolved into a passion for punk and the idea that rock music could provide a real platform for protest. We discuss his unique guitar playing style, the formation of Rage Against the Machine and their self-titled groundbreaking album in 1982, and the internal dynamic that eventually split the band up. We also talk about Tom's relationship with the late great Soundgarden singer Chris Cornell, with whom he formed the band Audioslave in 2001. We also cover the Rage, Public Enemy and Cypress Hill supergroup Prophets of Rage, his new project, the Atlas Underground, and of course, his view on the current political situation in America. But I started by asking Tom, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
First time I was aware of music was my great uncle Charlie Morello. Carlo Morello was a violinist for the Chicago Symphony Orchestra for 40 years. So it was him playing scales around family, the ancestral family home as a kid. And I thought that scales were music because that was, I knew that he was in the symphony and I knew that what he did was play scales. So that's what, that was my first exposure to music.
Was it, did it hold some kind of magic quality to you even then? How
it was, I mean, late, I was a little kid, maybe 3, 4, 5, something like that. Yeah. He passed when I was pretty little, but, I knew there was also a picture of him on the wall, a black and white photo of him in the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, probably from the 50s. And, you know, he was first chair of second violin. And so he was always kind of in the front there. And I was, you know, he was, I guess, a famous person in a way. You know, like he was on the wall and he was doing something that was real. And that always stuck with me, that there was music in the DNA.
Was a lot of music in the household.
My grandfather was a very talented pianist as well. And he had played for, they were, the one brother got to go off and seek his fortune with the symphony orchestra, and the other brother had to stay home and run the family business, which was a tavern. So he played with, he did the music for silent film.
Oh,
back
wow.
In the, you know, back in the day. I mean, my family, they're sort of generations are older. They were both born in the 1800s. Anyway, so he would do the music for silent film, and the house was always, when my mom and I visited, the house was always filled with whether it was Christmas music or, you know, 4th of July music or whatever.
What was the first piece of music that was yours, record that you were like,
the first record that was like I took some ownership of?
Yeah.
And my mom did have some like sort of Temptations around the house, but it was a Sweet Little Willie was the jam, and that resonated. It was very catchy and it was very rocking at the same time.
Were you one of those kids that would like put the needle on, watch it finish?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I had one song, you know, so that was gonna that was gonna be my jam.
In terms of thinking, well, this is okay, this thing I'm hearing, I would like to do this. People
no,
have
that
done
was
it
that was that was later. That was a little bit later. That was the first LP. The first LP, which was Kiss Destroyer, and that was I bought that. That was on sale at the grocery store back then. You could you're checking out with your 2% milk and your bowl of berries, and there's a Kiss record waiting for you. and I just as many youth of that era, Kiss became my favorite band before I heard a note of music. I just saw that cover and I was like, that is badass, man. I'm in. I'm all in.
Well, this is the thing, I think us over in the UK, we have a weird thing with Kiss because we sort of see them and just go, I mean, the image is kind of cool, but the music seems to be pretty bad.
Yeah.
But I think for a generation of American kids, it was like whole
they
package.
They were our Beatles. They really were. I mean, they were. They were the reason. I mean, it was the band that launched. You can look at, there was a whole generation of those grunge era bands from Nirvana to Smashing Pumpkins, Nine Inch Nails, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Jane's Addiction, Rage Against the Machine, Tool, all had huge Kiss fans in those bands.
What's the Kiss track we should play at this juncture?
Oh, I'd go with Detroit Rock City. Okay. It's a classic. It's the first song from that record. I'd go with that one. First gig I went to was Kiss as well.
All right.
It was at the Chicago Stadium. I was very excited to go to the show because imprinted on, I waited in a long, cold line outside of a shopping mall to go to Ticketron to buy my ticket. And I was very, very excited when I got my ticket because I believed that it was going to be like an introspective view into perhaps the nuanced poetic underpinnings of the band, because it said a partial view of Kiss. So I thought, oh, they're only going to be revealing certain elements of their artistic soul. What it meant was my seat was behind a pole. And so I had a pole completely blocking my entire view of the concert. And yet it was the most thrilling 2 hours that, of my life. It was pretty exciting.
Was that the kind of, was that the flashpoint of me?
No, because I couldn't project myself into that. I had a basement in suburbia, and they had limos and groupies and castles, and it was like a fantasy. They were like comic book heroes in a way that I admired and I screeched for, but it wasn't till I had the punk rock revelation that I thought that perhaps I could do it myself.
Yeah, we have to talk about the Clash, don't we, really?
Sure, the Clash and the Sex Pistols. It was actually the Sex Pistols cassette which physically propelled me into a band. I bought the Never Mind the Bollocks and was in a band. This is when I was 17. I was in a band before I knew how to play a note or a chord on the guitar.
Before the end of the album even finished.
Well, I played the first side a number of times in a row, and then the next day I marched down to the drama club of my high school and I said, a band is now forming. If you're going to be in the band, raise your hand. There's no experience required. I'm the guitar player because I have a guitar. I don't know how to play it, but I'm in the band.
Yes. So once again, thinking about that kind of US-UK thing, I see Sex Pistols and The Clash, the lyrics, as being quite uniquely, they're very British.
Sure, sure, sure.
What chimed for you as suburban US?
Yeah. Different. With each band, it was different. Like the Sex Pistols had that kind of nihilist aggression that, spoke to a teenage me, whereas The Clash were more honest than my teachers and the newscasters and the president. For example, the record London Calling, that made me, it made me think that music that was compelling need not be about the devil or groupies. And I thought music had to be about that because all my entire metal record collection was chock full. And I'm kind of not down with the devil and I don't have a castle on a Scottish lock and there's not a groupie in sight. And yet the riffs are pretty cool. But The Clash, it was very relatable. And then the really the moment that cemented it was I saw the Clash play at the Aragon Ballroom in Chicago, and in my mom's basement I had a little Music Man amp, sort of an inexpensive Music Man amp that was on a chair, and I saw the Clash play, and Joe Strummer had the exact same amp that I had on a chair on stage of the Aragon Ballroom, and it just erased the wall between performer and audience. It wasn't like, oh, one day I can do this too. It's like, I'm already doing it. Like, we're both doing it. He's doing it and I'm doing it.
Did you ever get to meet Joe?
I did. Spend some time with him. Yeah.
What was he like?
He was a character. He was a character. I met him. Rick Rubin was doing a soundtrack for something, and Joe was doing a song, and Rick asked me to come down, and Joe was holding court with a number of bottles of wine, and I have an old American muscle car, so that caught his attention. I don't know that I certainly didn't catch his attention, but he like was crawling around in my car. I'm like, Joe Strummer's in my car. How is that possible? But I got to, you know, hold the Telecaster and play that, and, you know, spend a little time just listening to him wax poetic about a wide variety of things. Yeah.
In terms of those people that you look up to, if you got Strummer, you got the Clash, who else as a guitarist did you want to be?
Yeah. Well, I had there were two areas that I was very much a part of that metal gunslinger mentality where you didn't want to just play great, you wanted to play better than him, you know. So I practiced 8 hours a day. I was practicing 8 hours a day every day because I started playing when I was 17, which was very, very late. I'd never heard of a guitarist who made a record who started that late, so I wanted to be the first one. So it was, for me, it was like Randy Rhoads, and he was my, you know, I named my first son Rhoads. It was the poster that was on my wall, and I was drawn to him because he was more musician than rock star. He reminded me a way of my great uncle, who practiced a lot and cared, and was also classically influenced. On days off from the Ozzy tour, he would take classical music lessons on, flamenco lessons on the nylon string guitar. And that really resonated with me. It's like my priority was not to become a star, it was to become a musician who was better than that other guy.
When was the point, because you do, and you have always, you have a very distinct approach
to the weirdness,
playing. Was there a point when you felt yourself going, I'm going somewhere where maybe other people have it's a road less traveled.
Yes, it was really around the beginning of Rage Against the Machine where I self-identified as the DJ in the band. And all of the sonics that entailed. And I began, rather than practicing 8 hours a day of Eddie Van Halen solos, I was practicing 8 hours a day of rhino noises and helicopters whirring and, you know what, footsteps passing by, like just whatever. And the blinders came, like, became very clear in my mind. The revelation was the electric guitar is a relatively new instrument on the planet, and it need not be confined to what people have done before. It's just a piece of wood and some wires that can be manipulated in a wide variety of ways that it can create unusual sounds, and sounds are the building blocks of songs. So you don't have to play like Chuck Berry or Keith Richards or Randy Rhoads or Joe Strummer. You can make a noise, and if you play it 8 times in a row, that's the verse. And that was the way I looked at it.
I think it takes a certain, almost, that commitment to an instrument takes a certain kind of tunnel vision, because maybe, you know, social life, your friends are buying cars, other stuff, and you're like, no.
You're on to something there. Sort of an obsessive compulsive disorder helps as well.
Are you kind of that guy?
Yeah, I was. I mean, in a way, it was about my self-analysis is that it was kind of about control. There were a number of things in my life that were not, I was the only black kid in an all-white town. There was sort of like some romance wasn't sort of a big part of the scene, but when I had that guitar, it was the only thing that was the determining factor of whether I would improve was my will, and I had that.
We always ask, I guess, when they first kind of became politicized, but for you, that's just kind of woven into the family DNA.
It's not
really a thing that happened.
Yeah, I mean, there was certainly politics in my home, but there was a real like watershed moment. I was literally, according to the real estate agent, the only black person to have ever inhabited Libertyville, Illinois. And so politics found me very early on the playground. You didn't need to go looking for politics when you're the only black kid. I lived in Illinois, but Illinois is the deep north. And so there'd be like name calling and this, that, and the other, and some like daycare incidents of violence where I sort of realized that there's some stuff isn't right in the world. But my mom, who's a very fiery, I'm half Kenyan and she's Irish Italian, born in the United States, but she is the most radical member of the Morello family. And when I was 4 or 5 years old, introduced me to the teachings of Malcolm X and how
four or five,
wow. as a survival tactic in daycare. Really, like this was not an esoteric conversation. This is like when the racist is coming, you must defend yourself by any means necessary. And I'm like, but I'm four, and it led to a scrum or two that was sort of a formative.
Yeah, because being in the minority is one thing. Being the singular,
it's very different.
That's who do you turn to? Who do you communicate with?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's kind of my path has been one of singularities in that way. I was the only black kid in an all white town. Then I was the only anarchist at a conservative high school. Then I was the only heavy metal guitar player at Harvard University. And then I was the only Ivy League wielding, punk metal guy in the Hollywood rock scene. So I've always, it hasn't been a large fraternity.
After those playground instances, do you think you almost sought out like positioned where you could be, okay, well, if I put myself in, then I will have to push myself further. I will have to stand up. I'll have to progress.
I mean, maybe, I mean, this is good therapy. I'm not sure that that's what I was, that's not what I was thinking. You might be onto something.
When did you first hear Public Enemy?
I'm not sure when I remember vividly, the Fear of a Black Planet is, everyone talks about Nation of Millions, which is an all-time classic, but for me it was Fear of a Black Planet and the song Fight the Power that really resonated. And I remember being on tour and listening to that cassette and just thinking, I can't believe that there's a group this good. Like, how, like, because it, both musically, it had this kind of almost like sort of the unconventional, deconstructed, avant-garde jazz feeling underneath it, and yet it was the greatest rapper that could ever be with that rich baritone voice telling the truth like no one had ever told it before on a record. And I'm thinking, and these are songs? Like, how do you get like that combination of awesome in one song? I couldn't believe it.
Also, even now, you go back and the production on someone went and go, oh, this is how you produce records? Nah.
Exactly. Exactly. Every way that a record had been produced, we're not going to do that. Yeah. And that's, I mean, that was that kind of a genius leap of faith into, like, we're going to make, you know, not dissimilar from the first Rage record. Like, we just did, there were no rules that we were following because we didn't really have a hope of anyone ever hearing it. So you just do what you want to do.
Public Enemy track should we play?
What's that? Let's go Fight the Power. You can't go wrong with that one. It's a jam.
Yet our best trained, best educated, best equipped, best prepared troops refuse to fight. Matter of fact, it's safe to say that they would rather switch than fight.
This is the first time with me, Matt Everett, and that was Fight the Power by Public Enemy, the choice of my guest this week on The First Time, Tom Morello.
This is BBC Radio Music. Now on BBC Sounds. Six Music.
No matter how hard you try, you can't stop us now. No matter how hard you try, you can't stop us now. Atomic age, atomic age, atomic age, atomic age.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music, where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is Rage Against the Machine guitarist Tom Morello. And that track you just heard was Renegades of Funk from Rage's final album, Renegade, from 2000. But let's start with an important first from the band's remarkable past.
The very first Rage Against the Machine gig. What can you remember from it?
I remember very clearly it was a house party in Huntington Beach, and when that band formed, there was no, it's hard to explain, like, how there was zero commercial ambition. There was no, I had been on a band before that had been on a label and was dropped from that label, and we were just making music that we loved. It was an interracial neo-Marxist punk, you know, hip hop, heavy metal band. There were none of those on the radio. There was not a record made by any band like that. And there was no band playing the LA clubs like that. So we didn't have any ambition of ever playing a show. So we were playing a living room party in Huntington Beach, like a friend's parents were out of town. But I got to tell you, the first song we ever played was Take the Power Back, and Tim begins that one. He was nervous, so he played about twice the speed of the song, and the living room exploded. Like, when the beat dropped, there was a huge mosh pit destroying the living room. At the time, we only knew five songs, so we just played them. We played the five songs, then we played the five songs again. And it was a visceral reaction and connection like I'd never been around anywhere in my life. And I thought, well, this is something different.
This is an awful name drop. We did the show with Dave Grohl, and, mm-hmm. and we were talking about Sound City Studios and mm-hmm. talking about yep. the first Rage album. And he was like, oh, you know, that was all done live.
Yeah,
and I was surely there's, and he was going, yeah, is it true the majority of that record was you with a bunch of friends around?
Yeah,
because you couldn't get it right.
We were trying to make a record a more conventional way at Sound City, and you know, we would go, even while we were recording the record, we'd go on weekends and go play gigs, and it was just roaring. And then we would come back to the studio, and it just didn't sound like the band. And so I, you know, humbly raised my hand one day and said, why don't we just invite some friends over and play the set a couple times through and just see what happens. I mean, this isn't working. So we did that, and we got about, I think, seven or eight of the basic tracks in, you know, in 2 hours.
That's insane.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and at the end of the day, it's obvious. And we've made, and then every record that Tim and Brad and I made, the Rage records and the All I Slave records, we always did it like that. Not always with friends in the studio, but always just, we're toe-to-toe, eye-to-eye, looking at each other and playing the songs.
Because that's a very unconventional way of making a record.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, the second record was made even crazier. We made it in a room half the size of the one we're in right now, in a rehearsal studio, because the band at the time wasn't getting along so great. So Brendan O'Brien, who was producing the record, was like, if I can get those four guys anywhere, we better just hit record. But, I mean, there was no separation between the drums and the bass. They were all right next to each other on that, right? It was just like... and. We put the board in the room across the hall and just played the songs down.
With Rage, that they're always from the outside anyway, there seemed to be tensions pretty much from
well spotted
from the start. Why was that?
I mean, how much time do you have? I mean, I can only sort of speak to sort of my role in it. I think that we a band that went from we had a offers from labels after our second show. We didn't get any sort of formative time as kind of friends and mates and comrades, you know, in the trenches. We went from like the trench for 2 days into, you know, doing interviews with the NME and Rolling Stone and figuring out how can you be a revolutionary band on a global scale with a major label? Like all this, like sort of these really big issues while we were in the water slide of activity. Like there was nonstop shows, there was nonstop press, there was nonstop sort of like attention for, and it, you know, we didn't, myself included, didn't have the emotional maturity, I think, to sort of process that in a way where we, you know, could have done better by each other. Also, all you gotta do is watch any band that you, every band, every 6 months should watch the movie Spinal Tap and make a checklist and go, oh, I'm sorry, dude, you're doing that right now. So you can't do that anymore. And we were certainly guilty of some of those.
But. What were your mechanisms for coping with that level of
It was, I mean, there was no, the mechanisms for coping were just emotional distress. And, you know, I will say, like, Rage Against the Machine, the shows never suffered and the albums never suffered, but it was suffering on a daily basis. Like, I would say in the 10 years of Rage Against the Machine, there were probably three happy days. Like, literally, like three. There were less than a handful of days where, yeah. During the reunion era, though, I will say that it was a different story. It was very low, and everyone had matured, and it was fun, and we greatly appreciated playing together. And the Finsbury Park show, where we had that number one, was the highlight of my musical career. Like that night was the best night of our, certainly with Rage Against the Machine, our musical lives. It was great.
Tell me, because obviously that's really close to the heart of everybody over here, feeling that, not just the campaign, because it wasn't really about a number one. It was about people coming together to make a statement.
Yes, absolutely.
And it almost wasn't about you as a band.
It wasn't at all. It wasn't at all. It absolutely does. That's why it was so great. It was a manifestation of the idea of Rage Against the Machine, wholly independent of the band or the song. And that's why, like, we didn't, I mean, it had a tremendous amount of momentum before I got an email that something was even happening. And then we got at the end and made a little push. But the celebration of the, you know, and it was so pure at the end, you know, it was the most downloads of a song in the history of the UK. You know, it was sweet because, like, you know, Simon Cowell was also on Sony, which was Rage Against the Machine was on. So Sony did not return our calls or emails during the entire time. and put zero physical albums, copies in the stores during the week because they wanted us to lose. Our record company wanted us to lose because Simon Cowell was the cash cow. And just for pure people power, defeated X Factor, defeated sort of the corporate monolith that was trying to, like, sort of suppress one of their own bands. Every penny that we made from those 580,000 that were sold that week, we gave away to charity. The show itself, we, you know, promised that it was going to be a free show. It was an absolutely free. We paid for every porta potty at that show, you know, and it was just it was completely pure celebration of, like, the goodness of mankind.
Now you do what they told you. Now you do what they told you. some of those that weren't forces are the same that brought crosses. Some of those that weren't forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that weren't forces are the same that burn crosses. Killing in the name of. Killing in the name of. Now you do what they told you. 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 Now you're under control. Now you do what they told you. Now you're under control. Now you do what they told you. Now you're under control. And now you do what they told you. Now you're under control. And now you do what they told you. Now you're under control. And now you do what they told you. Now you're under control. And now you do what they told you. Now you're under control. And now you do what they told you. Don't you die? I'm justified. But we're in the bad. Get your chosen life. You're justified.
What were your first impressions of meeting Chris Cornell? First time.
I'd met Chris, I think maybe at like a backstage at Lollapalooza 92 or and maybe at a barbecue at my house. And he was just a lovely dude. I was a huge fan. I mean, Bad Motor Finger was a cornerstone album for Rage Against the Machine. Mm-hmm. That was a huge, like the intelligence of the lyrics, the sort of the poetic indirection and the huge uncompromising metal riffs of it was a brand new thing. And Soundgarden, you know, like people like Chris sings great and they're one of the great grunge bands. What they did, and they predated Pearl Jam, they predated Nirvana, they redeemed metal and Jane's Addiction, but Soundgarden redeemed metal in that it made intelligent content a possibility with super heavy music, you know. Anyway, so Chris was meeting him when our timeline began with Audioslave, meeting him, my first impression was he was a very mysterious and shadowy person. I mean, he had a haunting thing that was absolutely real. Like, and you know, you read those lyrics and that's, you know, when it goes dark, all that's real. And Rick Rubin and I drove up to his house in Ojai, and he lived at the end of this, like sort of the last house on the left, and it's dusk, and you know, and there's a long stairway, there's some motorcycles out front, and the doors sort of open of their own accord, and out walks this lanky, you know, Chris is like 6'2", 6'3", this lanky figure coming down the steps, and you know, we hadn't really met, and Rick and I are in the car, and Rick turns to me and goes, "Let's get the F out of here." I'm like it is getting dark, maybe. But no, anyway, Chris was lovely. That was just the introduction. He did have that mysterious side, but he was a lovely person who cared a great deal about, you know, doing good in the world, and his effusive talent is something like he's unmatched, certainly during that era, and he's one of the greatest rock singers of all time.
Where were you when you first heard that Chris had died?
I was at home. It was like about 1 a.m. and my wife had the phone, and she had that look on her face, like that awful look when you know that someone, it's like something really bad happened. And, you know, I just kept saying to her, I was like, who? And then she finally said, Chris Cornell. No, come on. That can't possibly be true. And yet it was. Last time I saw him, he was shining. Yeah.
Prophets of Rage. I mean, it's quite a powerful combination of people. Yeah. And as well as part of your old kind of gang, it's two serious voices.
Yeah.
First rehearsal? I mean, how do you corral that
bit of corralling, but it's kind of like the Avengers in a way, you know. Like it was a dire time in the United States during the 2016 campaign, and you know, I saw on CNN there was the cry on red, Donald Trump rages against the machine. I said, oh hell no, like you don't get that, you don't attach that to that. And so of course I did what any self-respecting radical would do. I tweeted snarkily about it. And then I was looking at my phone going, I got to do better than that, man. I got to do better than that. So I called up some friends and I said, let's take the power back, shall we? And, Tim and Brad were down and we called Chuck first, and he was, Chuck's a very busy man, and he was a reluctant bride a little bit, and we had to kind of cajole him, but then he was in, and then Be Real joined, and it was, we were on a mission.
Underground then. So this sure. This is another even more disparate, seemingly disparate collection of musicians and
performers. I look at it as like all roads have led to this, and in a way, and that this is the Atlas Underground is a solo record under my name, and yet it's a sonic conspiracy that I've curated, and the idea was to bring together musicians of diverse genres, ethnicities, ages, and genders, which isn't of itself a statement, but to make a record that in 2018 combines, we have lofty ambitions, and that's to create a new genre of music, something that combines the Marshall Stack fury of riffs and crazy guitar solos that I'm known for and the huge drops of EDM, and to make an alloy that hasn't been gotten right yet, also to function in ways like as a Trojan horse, to inject radical poetic content and big fuzzy guitar onto the dance floor and onto radio, where currently neither of those things exist. And so we're a Trojan horse in that way as well. And the lyrical thread that runs through the Atlas Underground is social justice ghost stories. And the idea that the heroes and martyrs of the past and the fallen can find a voice in these songs to inform the struggles of the present and perhaps even light some sort of beacon for a more just and humane planet.
Still fighting?
Absolutely. Every day.
What's the last song we should play? We've had all these firsts. You get to pick the last.
Sure.
Anything you want.
Lucky One, which is the collaboration with K-Flay, and the underlying sentiment of this song. Like, if I had one wish for the world, it would be that everyone could become the person they were meant to be. But that is often not the case. Due to circumstance and often extreme poverty. So, for example, the next Mozart might currently be slaving away in a sweatshop making shoes in Vietnam, or the next, or the doctor who could potentially cure cancer might be in Alabama prison because they got caught with weed in their car. So this is about the idea of, you know, who dies first and who laughs last and who is the lucky one.
And that's what we shall end on. It's been good to speak to you.
Right on. Thank you very much for your thoughtful question.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music. A little bit of courage is all we have.
So catch me if you can. I'm going back.
Interested in just mishmashing the sound and see what you get.
Straight up bangers, obscure gems, and long forgotten favorites.
Well, we don't have a set list. We're trying to ensure that every show is different.
This is Old Noughties on BBC Sounds.
When it's time to party, we will party hard.